Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Alan Folsom, who discusses his new thriller, The Machiavelli Covenant, published by Tor Books. In the weeks to come, we have Chris Hedges, Kimberly Stewart, Sophie Kinsella, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Alan Folsom grew up in Massachusetts and attended Boston University, where he won the National Rosenthal Award for screenwriting. After graduation, he went to California to pursue a career in the entertainment industry. There he worked in documentary films as an editor, cameraman, writer, director, and producer. His experience in documentaries led to work as a writer for dramatic films, both theatrically and in television. Over a period of nearly 20 years, he wrote for most of the major motion picture studios and television networks and developed screen and teleplays for such stars as Natalie Wood, Elizabeth Taylor, and Robert Wagner. In the late 80s, he decided to try his hand at writing novels. In 1993, his first novel, the international thriller, The Day After Tomorrow, sold for an advance of $2 million, which, at the time, was the highest figure ever paid for a first novel. Since then, The Day After Tomorrow has been translated into no less than 25 languages. We're delighted that Alan is with us this evening at the Tattered Cover to present his new novel, The Machiavelli Covenant. Would you please join me in making Alan Folsom feel welcome?
Thank you all for coming. It's very nice to see you. And here I am, just flown in from California, and I'm flying out in the morning, so this is what they put you on a tour for, I guess. You know, if it's Tuesday, it must be someplace. So, anyway, what I really like to do when I get together with people come in to see and chat and whatever is just to do question and answer and kind of get to know each other a little bit. So if there's anything you want to ask or we can get to or interests you, please feel free. Yes, sir. It wasn't quite that long, but yeah. Right. The question was how long between books, how long it takes to write them. The last book before this book, The Machiavelli Covenant, was The Exile, and that was the longest. That took me 3 years to write. But that was a huge... the manuscript of that was over 1,300 pages. So it was really... It took a long time. Books tend to dictate their own length and how long it takes to write them. And if I have to do a lot of research, on my second book, Day of Confession, I went to Italy and spent a lot of time talking to the Italian police and going around the Vatican and trying to get some real sense of how all these things work. And then when I came back from there, I met a very fine man as a detective on the Rome Police Department. And he said, this was the day before email, and he told me, if you have any questions, just fax them to me. Well, I faxed them to him. He didn't speak English, so I had to he had them translated into Italian, answered the questions, had them translated back into English, and then faxed to me. So sometimes I'd ask a question, and it might be 3 weeks before I got the answer. So things take a little bit of time, and they work themselves out. In the new book, Machiavelli Covenant, I was fortunate enough to develop a relationship his exact title was at the time, but he was basically the head of the Southern California area for the U.S. Secret Service. And now we're in the day of email and not faxes so much. And he was very, very responsive. I think he enjoyed a great deal being part of this. But what I would do in the situation, I don't know how many of you have read the book or familiar with it, but it has to do with the the exploits of the President of the United States on the run from people who are having a coup against him in his own government. So when I got to certain situations, I would, if you're going to deal with the United States president, you have to deal with the Secret Service, because they're the ones that's their job to protect him or protect the office of the president. So when I'd get to a certain situation, I just email him and say, well, here's the situation, what would you guys do? And so it sort of helped me write the book a little bit. They can't tell you everything, obviously, but they told me enough to make it believable, which is what I always try to do in my work. Another reason it takes long, even though these are kind of broad concepts, when you get down to it, you talk to the people who might actually be involved and you present the situation, and then you ask them what they would do, especially with professionals in law enforcement and so forth. So, but he was great. He just loved it. I could email him at 10 o'clock at night, and wherever he was in the world, 20 minutes later, I'd get an answer. It was great. It was like he was sleeping with this thing. I don't know. But he was terrific. So anyway, that's a long way around how long it takes to write a book. And you know, and the other thing is, I've been asked before why they don't come out faster. I mean, publishers and agents both would like you to turn out a book a year. They get paid faster, and it's a lot easier to count on things. And I've said for a long time, I'm not a manufacturer. You know, I said, if you want to turn out, we can turn one of these out every 4 months. We'll just do it like television. We'll get a group of writers. We'll sit around a table, and everybody will hammer it out, and it's like a television series. But they didn't think that was such a good idea. So they sort of have to wait for it, you know. And every once in a while, I have to take a little breath between books and figure out where I am, you know. And a friend of mine, to extend this just a little bit, a friend of mine is a very popular writer, and he's had time between books. And I asked him once, I said, you know, you have basically the same question, why so long between books? He said, well, you know what's in that cave and you don't want to go back inside. I guess the basic question is the involvement of presenting these as a piece, presenting the novels as a piece of work that could be television or movies. First of all, my training is in that. So the scenes in themselves are dramatic scenes. They're written with a lot of dialogue and a lot of dramatic setup. They're not written with a lot of narrative. You know, I kind of hopefully let you experience them as I do them. So right there, you have a little bit of a screenplay or a teleplay. On the other hand, they're very complex, and I guess to say they're complex, multi-charactered, and long. And these days, Hollywood doesn't like complex, multi-charactered, and long. As you can see, what they're making is cartoons for the most part, with the exception of Little by Little, which I find very interesting, are the independent films that are coming along that are a lot more interesting than the studio pictures, at least from my point of view. The trouble is, with independent pictures, they don't have the kind of budgets that you need for the kind of stories that I write. So yes, to answer the question, yes, I would like them to be done. My first book was turned into a... I wrote the first draft of the screenplay. We had some major Hollywood players. MGM bought the rights to it. And then what happens is, one of the reasons I got out of Hollywood was, as soon as I got done with the screenplay, they fired me and hired somebody else. And then after that, they fired them and hired somebody else after that. And then they fired them and hired somebody else after that. So to this day, they put in $6 million in screenplays, haven't shot a foot of film, and the thing will probably never be made. Which is one of the reasons I stopped. I said, I can't do this anymore. It's a nice way to make a living, but nothing ever happens, you know. So anyway, that's a long way around to answer your question. Hopefully, this new book, The Machiavelli Covenant, I think from a marketing point of view, and nothing else but a marketing point of view, might be the most attractive of them all, because it's easy to sell. The concept is easy to sell. And if anybody wants anything these days in Hollywood, it's the marketing people. It's easy. They don't want to work. They want something that's easy. So we'll see. We got our fingers crossed. It's out to a bunch of producers and studios right now, so we'll see what happens. Anybody else? Come on, Kate. You must have something.
Far out stuff going on.
Well, the Nazis are kind of far out guys, you know.
Not the good far out.
Well, yeah, not a good far out at all. But the question was, how did I come to write my first novel, and was it because it was easy to use the Nazis as bad guys?
Yeah. chapter.
Okay. The answer is yes and no. And I wanted to do a story that was, how do I want to put this? I grew up with a family of displaced Germans after the Second World War. And they had fled, they were Germans, and they had fled the Nazis. And I lived from at a very young age for 4 or 5 years kind of with these people a lot. And I got a real sense of, as a kid would, being around other kids but from a different background and listening to stories about how they fled. They were at one point, the Germans were behind them trying to catch them and kill them, and the Americans were in front of them trying to kill them. So, and this is a father with 11 children and a mother. So it was a rough, you know, at best. There's a whole movie and a novel in itself. But they, so it implanted in me some sense of Germany and also some sense of, strangely enough, the Teutonic mind or the Teutonic being or whatever it was, because they were very, very strong people. You know, on top of all that, they were very German, you know. They just weren't Nazis, you know. So, but later on as I grew up, I just had this feeling we are not done with that mentality. We're not done with that mindset. And I also felt it was really important for me. By that time, I had a daughter who was, was probably a year or two old, and it got me thinking about how important it was for the younger generation, the upcoming generations, to be made aware of what happened. And all really what they learned about it is either through kind of movies or through history books. You know, it's not happening today. It happened before. It has no meaning to me. And I was trying to bring something very contemporary that says, this is still, you got to pay attention to this and pay very close attention to this. So I guess that was my way of just raising the flag, saying, don't forget what happened. You know, that was the real underlying sense of making. You know, there's a wonderful old thing that they used to tell you in movies when you're going to sit down, and when you're first learning about screenwriting, not in college, but in the real business, you know, is that they would say, make it simple for yourself, make it simple for the audience. In the first scene, a Nazi bites a baby's head off. Right. So what do you do with the rest of the movie? You try to get the Nazi and kill him. I mean, that's simple enough. Everybody understands it, you know. So, again, that, you know, when you make the ultimate bad guys the bad guys, it's easy. It's, you know, when you get to contemporary bad guys, well, we all know what's going on, but we don't really want to get into that at this stage of the game. It's much too complex. Right, right. And not only that, you know, one of the most important things to me in writing, whether it's a novel or a screenplay or teleplay, or poetry for that matter, is you can't just tell a story, you know, for the reader or for the audience. Hopefully they'll feel something. You know, there's some emotion there. It's not just, let me tell you a story, you know. I'm reading a book now that I don't want to name. It's a very popular book, but it's just, it's interesting, but it's flat. You know, there aren't dramatic scenes. I don't really care about the characters. They're not that well developed. And I've always just believed that if something's well written, it'll come up off the page and get you. You know, and you're going to feel something about it, and you want to keep reading. I've always had a theory about whether a book is good or not. And this, you know, my 12th grade English teacher would come over and smack me hard for saying this. But what makes a book good or not good is it's good if you want to turn the page. If you don't, it's not. You know. So, you know, granted, you have to give a little of yourself, and you can't be a moron. Or, you know, it helps to work a little bit sometimes. But if you want to keep reading, it's to you, it's worth reading. You know. So, anyway, again, a long way around. Okay. Yeah. Anybody else? No, come on. Somebody's got to have a question. Okay. Yeah, a little bit. They didn't know I was there. And writing Day of Confession, did I have access to the Vatican? Actually, I had my Italian publisher, or actually my then Italian agent who was based in Milan, was very helpful in setting up my meetings, as I said, with the Rome police. And police, by the way, are very difficult to work with if you just come in off the street and say, I'd like to talk to you. They're very, very standoffish, and they want to know who it is and what they're going to be meeting and who they're going to, what they're going to say. And I found that around the world. It was even more so with the Secret Service. They really are very careful about who they talk to and what they say. But in the Vatican, he was able to set up a meeting with, I'm not so sure exactly what department, but saying that I was doing a novel and I was a novelist, and could I get somebody, would they give me somebody to show me around? So they did this wonderful Italian lady, and she basically took me all over the places where we were allowed to go. I would spend a lot of time in the Vatican Garden, and I don't know if you recall, is one of the end scenes is in the Vatican radio station, and I went up in there and looked in, and looked around. You have a real sense when you rock, can go to these places of not only a place that you might use for a set or a scene, but how it might all work. You know, and Vatican Radio was a place where you broadcast from. You broadcast, you know, the Vatican political gospel out of that. And so you go in there and you just have this sense of this is where this part of their world happens. You know, I was not allowed or not shown into the papal chambers. I never met the Pope or any of that kind of stuff. But I was given access to a lot of places that, you know, you would have to have somebody call and make appointment ahead of time and say, could you show this person, blah, 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 blah. But, yeah, I spent about 3 days just kind of wandering around there saying, what can we do here, what can we do there? And it's the whole thing with the Iron Gate where the trains come in, you know, and the train station that's still in there. I can't remember what Pope it was, but the Pope had used that a lot as a jumping-off point for politics during during and after the Second World War, and that was also his escape route. If the Vatican was attacked, they were going to take an armored train out of there with a Pope and you know all his gunmen with it. So that was primarily why that was built at the time and why that huge iron gate is in there. So, and I walked around there and I walked down the railroad tracks and I looked at the old rusting rails and I said, well, this is interesting. You know, what can we do with this? So Hitchcock used to love to think of locations, you know, where he could do things. In the new book, most of it takes place in Spain and a lot in Barcelona. And then I went up into the monastery at Montserrat, which a big part of the book takes place in the monastery, or an important part of the book takes place in the monastery. Well, it's a very interesting place to get to. First of all, you have to take a train or a bus or a tour bus from Barcelona, and then where I got one, we took the train to take a cable car up to it. And this ancient place, it's basically a tourist attraction now. There's monks, and they do religious services and all that, but it's just jammed full of tourists. It's like I don't want to say Disneyland, but it's as busy as Disneyland, that's for sure, you know. So I love to go and find places, and if you walk around it, you really get a sense. You can do it from books and from the internet now. In The Exile, I wrote it. There's a whole ending scene in the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, Russia, that I was not able to get to, but fooling around on the internet, I happened to find a live camera from right inside the Hermitage, so I could go from room to room and see exactly what was going on. It was terrific. You know? I missed a trip to Russia, but I got what I needed. You know. So, anyway, you sure to go out and do it. And again, that's why it takes a few years between books. They just don't fall off the shelf. You know. And I guess if they did fall off the shelf, 20 or 30 books, then your life's over, you know. The fun is in doing it, you know. I remember as a kid, my parents were wonderful. We had a little teeny house, and I had an electric train, and I wanted to expand the setup, and I wanted to put it on a board and make little villages and all this kind of stuff. And my parents actually moved out of their master bedroom into my little teeny bedroom, and my father put three or four big 4x8 sheets of plywood on sawhorses that I did this gigantic layout for my trains, which was, it took me probably 6 months to do it, you know, and it was wonderful. My parents, when I was 8 years old, to move out and let me do that. But I did that and put all those pieces, painted all the roads, did all the crossways, all that. And I probably, when it was done, I probably ran the train around it three times and said, all right, let's rebuild it, you know. The fun was in doing it, and the fun was not in running the train around it, So the fun is in writing a book. It's nice to hold it up and say, here, I did this, and have people like it and enjoy it. But the real fun is just in doing it. You know. So anyway, again, a long way around. A simple question. Anybody?
Yep.
The question is, have I written anything that I've gotten in trouble for? Sometimes just getting up in the morning I get in trouble, but no, actually not. In fact, my one of my aunts, who has since passed away, wrote a letter to the New York Times saying, were they afraid to do a review of the book because they were, you know, beholden to the Catholic Church? And she was a published poet. She was a very well-known woman, and she never heard back from them. You know, and I kept saying, "Gee, I wish the Vatican would ban this book. We could really sell a lot. You know? And it would be great if they just come condemn it. It would be wonderful." You know? Because I figured there's a billion Catholics in the world. If we could sell to 1% of them, we'd be in great shape. You know? But no, so far, as far as I know, you know. So although I haven't applied for membership in the church, maybe I'm on the blacklist, you know. And then the other one, so far not yet, you know. My stories, in a way, are more personal. They're not as the politics are involved, but they're people involved. They're not institutions that are involved quite as much. In Day of Confession, it was really the politics of the Secretary of State who was carrying out his own idea of what the Catholic Church should do. It wasn't the Catholic Church making these decisions. Had I gone that way, you know, I probably would have been condemned and be wealthy. So, anyway, no. Anybody else? Well, that's a good reason to ask a question.
Are you what you call a very disciplined writer?
What is my schedule for writing? Well, I am a disciplined writer, but it's not first thing in the morning. I tend to be, much to my wife's chagrin, a night person, so because she's a day person, but... Usually, yeah, I do write every day, and most of these books, once I get started, getting the concept and the whole idea before you even work is half the battle, because that's not an easy thing to do. But once I get started, I know, with a few exceptions, I write 6 and 7 days a week. And this last book took me 2 years, the book before took 3 years. But I tend to write mainly in the afternoon. I usually do take my daughter to school and do business in the morning or exercise. I do a lot of bike riding, so I try to do a nice bike ride in the morning, come back and have lunch and go over my notes and take a nap, and then I get to work, and I probably write from 3 till 7 or 8 if I can. That's my best hours, and then once everybody goes to bed, I go back and maybe work for another hour or two at night.
Do you regress every day, you know, like...
No, because... I sort of keep a running notation of what I'm doing. And not only that, most of my books take place over a short amount of time, a week or two. And the new one takes place over 8 days. And I kind of keep a track on a line, what's happening today, who's doing what today, because it means a lot. Things are happening at a very quick pace. And when something happens, you can't just say, well, you know, especially if people are under fire, important things are happening. You can't really take... 3 pages and say, you know, when I was a kid and went fishing with my grandfather, I mean, it kind of takes all of it, unless that pertains to the story. And then if it pertains to the story, you can do that. But I rewrite all the time, but the momentum is what's important. And quite often, I write without an outline. I write roughly where I'm going. I'll tell you why. When you do movies and television, if you get hired to do a project, usually what happens is you have to do a complete, what they call a step outline, from beginning to end. In a feature film, it's 3 acts. In a television movie, it's 7 acts, or was when I was doing it. I don't know what they do now. And each one of those had to be, for instance, in television, you had 7 acts, 7 scenes to an act was the basic rule of thumb for that. So they all had to be outlined exactly, and it had to go through the network people, and it had to go or the studio people, and everybody had to make it. So by the time it's done, everybody knows pretty much what's going to be written, and they say, go off and write it. But by then, it's so predictable, at least to me. I've been over it so many times. I know exactly what's going to happen. And it takes a spontaneity out of it. When I'm writing a novel, not only you can go back and forth in time in a novel that you can't really do in a movie, is... I know my main characters, I know the main setup, the main situation, and I know pretty much where I want it to end and who's going to be in it. But then I let it just happen. And it's just, it's amazing. You know, these are sold as thrillers or whatever they're, you know, the marketing people sell them all, but they're basically adventure stories. And it's an adventure. There's an author, and I really need to look him up because I keep misquoting who said it, but I keep saying it was Dashiell Hammett. It may not have been. But he used to say, my characters don't know what's around the corner. Why should I? You know, and it really is a good, you just surprise yourself. When you say, where did that come from? That's really interesting. Or in the case of Machiavelli, I'd get in a certain situation and I would email the Secret Service. What do you do here? Well, they might tell me in an entirely different direction than I was pre-thinking. No, we wouldn't do that. We'd do this. Well, that turns you right around going the other way, and sometimes it turns you back on your other characters. So it's a whole adventure in itself, and that, again, that's half the fun of it. But it's, you do a lot of rewriting, because I'll start down a road and I'll say, wait a minute, this isn't working, or it's going the wrong direction, and have to back up to where it was working. And that can be, well, it's not only tedious. As I said in The Exile, I had 1,336 finished pages of manuscript. Probably means I wrote 3,000 or 4,000. You know, so again, that takes time. You got to make mistakes, but you got to know when you're making a mistake. That's the whole key to it. You know, an artist friend of mine said years ago, you get to a point in your career as a creator, and you never really know if it's working, but you really know if it's not working, and that's one of the real keys of kind of developing your craft. You know. I don't know anybody who says, I'm convinced this is just perfect, because the minute you say that, it usually isn't. But you certainly know this is definitely not working, and you stop it there and figure out, what do you do next? So that's one of the real keys to it. Anybody? It can't be done so soon. Who has influenced my writing in the past? Is that right? Right. One of the things that I can't speak for all writers, but a lot of writers, once they start writing, their entire life they've read and read and read. Once they start writing, they don't read anymore. I mean, I read all the time for research, but to actually put my feet up and read a novel, very difficult, especially if I'm working all day. The last thing I want to do when I'm done is do some more of the same kind of brain work, even if it's somebody else's. You know, and I always I had trouble, too. Early on, when I try to do that, I'd pick up the ear of the other writer and their timbre and their way of their rhythm of writing, and would get caught in mine. It'd take me half a day to get back on track. So, but in the past, you know, all the great, you know, probably one of my favorite books growing up was Northwest Passage. I don't know how many read, but that was in junior high school. It was a great book, great adventure. But In all the classics that you have to read in school, and some you really like and some you don't like. But then I got, Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, the great mystery writers and I think I read about everything Louis L'Amour ever wrote. You know, just a wide variety of things. Again, going back to the... Strangely enough, as I get older and spend more time writing, some of the things that everybody has said are so terrific that you have to read, that you go back and read, they aren't so terrific, you know. At least not to me. After you get a sense after a while, you say, why is this paragraph here? Or what is this character doing? It sort of stops and starts, and I don't know why it's here. I was reading a thing in the LA Times yesterday about some producer, one of the 900 producers, is trying to get Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged made into a film. Well, they've had more problems with that over the years. First of all, it's almost unreadable, but it's one of the most popular books of all time. So, you know, go figure from that point of view. But to sit down and try to actually make a book out of it, I mean, a movie out of it, that's really tough, because not an awful lot happens. It's all philosophy, you know. And movies are, philosophical movies are not easy to make, you know. And not ones that sell tickets, anyway. You know. So, anyway, yeah, just basically, you know what it is? A lot of reading from a young age. Just having your head in a book and reading and reading and just enjoying that world completely, you know. So, And I think there's probably a period like we all do when we're in our late teens or early 20s, we get all enthralled with intellectualism. And so when you start reading all the French and the existentialists and just think this is absolutely terrific, you know, read them 20 years later and see how they sit. Maybe they sit fine, but it depends on the person. But anyway, that's just a lot of reading was my influence. And my father used to say, there's a great book over there in the corner that I don't think you've read very much of. And I said, what's that? He said, The Dictionary. So, in fact, he had a great thing. I asked him, what does this mean? He said, you're asking me when there's a dictionary over there? Now, I don't know if he didn't know the answer. Anyway, anybody else? I guess I'm very happy everybody came. It's really nice to have a turnout and get to meet people. I just did it last week in Portland. I had a wonderful time. I'll do it again tomorrow in Kansas City and next day in Seattle, and then I'm on to the East Coast. But it's really great to come and talk to people and see. I'm in that cave for a long time. It's nice to come out of it.
Were you at Hunters in Portland?
Excuse me?
Were you at Hunters in Portland?
Powell's.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Hunters in London.
I don't know. Yeah, Powell's. Yeah. It's almost as nice a store as this one. And, you know, what's really great is you go out, and there's a lot of people that I meet, obviously, from the chains. And they're terrific, but to come to independent stores, and there's so few and far between these days, we've lost so many of them, to find them and to find enthusiasm for them is just terrific, and I hope we just keep going on and on with them. Okay. So...
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Chris Hedges, Kimberly Stewart, Sophie Kinsella, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on January 16th, 2007.